Welcome to Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Do you take playing with your toy soldiers seriously?
They're historical miniatures, Chantel.
Well, these nerds sure do. Here are your hosts, Tom Castaños, Richard Martinez, and Ray Winstead.
Welcome back to Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Thank you, Chantel, for that lovely introduction. Remember to like and share the podcast. That's how more people find us. If your podcatcher allows you to rate and review, please do so. And also, you know, if you want to drop us a buck, that's cool too. You can buy me a beer on the buzzsprout.com webpage, or you can join us at Patreon. Patreon.com/ABA1. We've been talking a little bit about the fact over the last months or so that we were given a lovely opportunity by the authors of the Blood and Steel game, which if you're not familiar with, it's kind of in the Blood and Plunder family from Firelock Games, but it represents skirmish combat in the horse and musket era. Basically, the current list of armies goes from the Seminole War all the way up to the Spanish-American War in the 1890s. Edgar Pabon and Damien McCumber have been very kind to us as far as giving us a ton of support. And they actually even gave us an advanced copy of their kind of push-pull campaign system, of which we were involved with. And we tested it with British Colonial Zulu Wars. And we have finished that campaign.
Hey, we finished a campaign.
Yeah, yep. By and of itself, that's a remarkable event.
I was
going
to say, end the episode right now. That's a high note.
That's right. And I think it went great. So, Ray, I'll let you start as the British player who did subsequently lose the campaign, but it wasn't one-sided by any stretch of the imagination. Tell us a little bit about it.
But the last game of the campaign.
But not the campaign in general.
Sort of hit a low note for the British. I thought the game and the campaign had a great deal of flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very convincing. It really portrayed the period as I've read in most of the books I've read. That feel comes through very well.
Yep. I could, you know, we've talked about this before, but I could, it felt very Zulu Dawn-ish. It felt very Zulu, you know, it kind of had that movie feel to it, which is cool because that, you know.
And the last game played out very much like Isildur.
Yeah, exactly. You were riding off with the flag and we drug you into the river and drowned you and took the flag away. But that's an excellent point. I feel like one of the greatest compliments that I can give is the fact that it felt right. You know, we played it and we questioned some stuff and particularly Edgar was so good about being practically the fourth player from Florida because we could text and call him right away if like, hey, what the hell do we do with this? And boom, he was like right there all the time. So that we really appreciate that input.
Yeah. Only all rule systems were like that.
No kidding.
Customer support like
no
that.
Kidding, you know. we have a couple of inns where people help us out like that.
Yes.
But yeah. Rich, what are your takeaways?
My biggest takeaways was it was a very fun set of games. The campaign rules were not overly complicated.
Far
it was a very simple template to lay over the base game system, which was good because for me coming in, it was, I know you and Ray had played a couple of games and had done a Millennium Con piece of it. I was coming to basically a new game system. It was nice to know that the campaign just kind of just was an add-on to what that was. But it was nice to have games have meaning. for the next set of games. And we had this little progression going on with points, and leaders got to upgrade as you kind of reach these milestones. We learned, I think you and I had some kind of talks about it. And each game, I think we kind of refined our tactics, tried to at least. It didn't always work out because the nature of the dice are the nature of the dice, and it works that way. But I liked, so fun, not overly complicated. There was a learning curve to it. And it was just, it was a great experience. It brought back a lot of the, you know, the reasons why we get like to get together for this hobby. Yep. No dice throwing, except for Ray Parton, part. But for the most part, no arguments, no breakdowns. Everyone had fun.
When things finally went wrong for me, at least they went wrong in a way that was very in keeping with what was supposed to be going on.
Yeah.
Right. There was no sense that there was a broken rule. It's just that this was the way the history played out.
It felt very natural, and it felt very organic to what was going on the table.
I don't know. Do we want to kind of give like a little summary of the games and how they walk through, or is that good for the impressions first?
Let me start with this. I think we've said enough about it. Let me explain just a little bit how the campaign works. All right. So first of all, if you're not familiar again with Blood and Steel, one of the things that I really enjoy about it is that you have a deck of mission cards. There's not many of them. I don't know how many, but there's just a handful. And each side pulls a mission card and keeps it secret from the other side. So you don't know what the other person is trying to accomplish for their victory conditions. And likewise, they don't know what you're trying to accomplish. So there really is a nice little fog of war built into that. So you're not immediately huddled over the thing to defend whatever. You know, here come the enemy. What are they trying to do? Are they trying to overwhelm me? Are they primarily concerned with defending an area? So it plays into that. And then they've written into the campaign that there are specific cards that are used. You know, at the beginning, I think pretty much they were all available. Mm-hmm. And then whoever is the winner or the loser, it's sort of a ladder campaign. So game two, the loser has, and both sides have a restricted number of these campaigns. So the little missions are more related to the situation of someone following up on an attack versus someone reeling from being defeated, and likewise onto a third game, which is supposed to be the culminating event. Leave it to us to not finish in three games. We actually fought a second game to a draw, which required us to replay the second game with all starting with some fatigues and all kinds of things. So you were beaten up and you were going to have to continue the same fight with the same troops.
At the same mission.
Same missions. That's right. You couldn't change the mission
on that draw card, on that draw game. Yes.
And that was pivotal. You know, it really was. So in a nutshell, that's the thing. And Rich also alluded to the fact that the winner, if your leader survived, you got to up your skill set. You gained some little advantages. And that did play a role in it, that our leader, after the second game, actually could do a little bit more than he could previously.
Yeah, he was able to modify the dice by one or plus one or minus one to help you get the advantage in your initiative.
Yeah, so he gained some experience. So what is typically supposed to be a three-game series, right? But if any game draws, you replay that game. We wound up playing three games.
Yeah, I'll say this is a good dynamic. You're right. I want to explain what happened.
Because at the end of the replay of the second game, we did the math and there was no way left for the British to win.
Come out.
Right.
Even if we played the third game, it was going to be just for die rolling, which we could have done.
In fact, it was at the point where I could not have even tied it. So
Because
no matter how the next game went, I was going to lose the campaign.
Yeah, so
First game, I think, first game was a Zulu victory. The second game was a draw.
Mm-hmm.
We squeaked out a Zulu victory again in the third replay of it. And so we were two victories with only one game left to play. So it was just a matter of deciding what magnitude of victory the Zulu victory was going to be.
Just to fill out the narrative, we could have played that one, but we opted to, you know, declare a victory because we'll get to this in a little bit. We're going to move on to yet another one. But you're right. You mentioned it gave the game a purpose.
It
inspired us to get our lazy, you know what's back at the place and play again fairly quickly for us, right?
For us, yes.
To me, those are all wins.
Mm-hmm.
100% wins. I'm still very proud that as of 2024, although there were some hiccups in late March and early April, we've still played more than typically, you know, repetitively. We've gotten in more games, at least two a month.
Right.
And I've been fortunate. I've played almost every single Friday somewhere or another. So that's, you know, that's a win. A game played is a win, you know, at this point in time. But a meaningful game is a real win. And I would argue these were all meaningful games. Yeah,
they were. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would not mind going back and replaying this whole campaign from the start again.
I agree.
Because the way the game plays out and the way the campaign system adds to it, you have a lot more replayability.
100%
in the game.
You can play the exact same scenario with the exact same forces, but with the exception of Ray, the draw of those cards is going to be random every time. I bring that up because Ray has drawn the same exact card every single time he's played.
Out of, like, what have we played? Like, five games now?
Mm-hmm.
Six games?
Yep.
I've gotten the exact same mission
every single game. We've unilaterally agreed that if he draws it again, he gets to redraw so that he has some opportunity to play more of the game system than.
And there are a lot of cards in the deck.
Yeah.
So the odds of drawing the same card are.
Yeah, there's at least like a dozen different things, and he's just drawing the same one over and over and over. But then Rich and I, one game that we played just on our own, we'll get to in a bit, both drew the same card in two consecutive games. So that's, you know. And maybe we've all been gaming together too long, but no, you're right. I mean, you could draw. I go back to the old days of the fantasy trip and the little programmed adventures. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to go left in the dungeon, go to page 86 or whatever, that was going to play out the same. But then, you know, you rolled for the little goonies and it could change a little bit. This is going to change dramatically every time you play it.
Right.
Because, I mean, again, if you win the first game and your commander gets a cool bonus or whatever, that's going to dramatically affect the second game.
Well, even if you do exactly the same campaign with exactly the same forces, unless you're me, you're going to have a different mission card in the game.
That's right. That's right.
So you might not be doing anything close to what you did in the first game of the last campaign. That's
exactly right. And Rich hit on something too, and I think this is a subtlety of these rules. The first game we played, we were all surprised kind of how long the game took.
Yes.
But it's the only one that was that way.
Right.
We probably fumbled around a little bit and, you know.
At the most, text messages to Edgar to help clarify
exactly.
Rules. Yeah. We're learning the rules.
By game two, we're cooking along pretty good. And by the replay of game two, it was nothing. It could easily have been an evening game.
Yeah.
Although we had been playing these on Friday nights when we had time. Nobody has to be anywhere Saturday morning. And the store that we play at is open until midnight. So, we were good to go. But we were finished long before that. So what you said was after the first game, we talked and rethought some of our strategy. And I know... Yep. Ray rethought his strategy about, kind of a crossfire versus a lump together, everybody shooting in the same direction kind of thing. So I think it speaks volumes to a game that we've gone beyond the mechanic of the rule and started thinking about the strategy.
How to apply.
Yeah, the tactics,
your
right?
force to what you're trying to accomplish.
The last thing you want to do is be looking up a caveat in the rule to screw over your friends. You want to screw them over with tactics.
We do that enough to ourselves.
Exactly.
Like, oh, we're supposed to do this? I didn't know that.
Exactly.
But no, I think it was very indicative of how the different forces were structured. Obviously, with Ray playing the British, he obviously had fewer figures than we had. We had tons of Zulus running on the board. Mm-hmm. But he even had, which I think served him well, mm-hmm. all these extra add-ons to his army. So, for example, right, instead of just the base leader, he had the captain that was giving out two commands per turn.
I upgraded my command.
He had his bugler that, or drummer, whatever, musician that was giving him double command the range. He was putting NCOs in his units. So, I mean, these were all little tight, little, what I would call, for lack of a better term, like these little fortress units that, you know, were self-contained and were very flexible. You and I, that first game.
On their own, none of the advantages were huge, but together, the synergy between all those different advantages.
Yeah.
That was a terrifying amount of fire coming out of those handful of little dudes.
Like when his leader got to go, you were like dreading. You're like, oh, he got two commands. He's going to kill these guys and then still be able to do all these other things. And whereas in our first game, which I'm not quite sure how we pulled it off, but we won, we were working with one leader for the whole army. So we had like,
basic
six or seven units.
With one command, right?
Right, one command. Our guys were going up very, very piecemeal. It wasn't until game two we realized, oh, we can afford, you know, the 10 points or 20 points to buy that second leader for your force.
Yeah.
So that we gained some of the same kind of flexibility, had two commands over two different models, whereas Ray had it.
But it's intimidating as a Zulu player when you don't bring any ranged weapons and you just run up and watch half of one of your units dissolve under his fire, his rifle fire. It's like, well, that was quick, you know. You go from 10 to 5 figures, you know, and like instantly.
That's why you're like hugging every piece of terrain that you can find out there.
But likewise, the longer it takes to get there, the more fire you take. Even undercover, you're still got the opportunity of being, you know, unless you're completely out of sight.
Well, one thing that I found unusual is as we got deeper into the campaign, I don't know if it wasn't purposeful because you and I hadn't talked about this, but what was happening is holding back, you know, advancing on cover as best we could to limit Ray's firing opportunities, kind of waiting for Ray's dice luck to kick in and waiting for the mishap that was going to happen, the calamity roll. And then we pounced on him and then we took advantage of that because it was tough. Yeah, with that leader and that fire that they put out and their unlimited range and the ability they didn't have to reload.
Yeah.
Was a daunting task to go down and try and get into combat.
It was. Now, once you got into combat, that's when the world changed.
Yes.
You had to clear,
and even to add one more to that, it was get into combat, and then the cherry on top, because even that wasn't a safe bet, because I remember that second game where we drawed, I got into combat, and he wiped me out, right, with his counterattack.
Yeah.
It was getting into combat with multiple units on one of his units was where the key came up.
Yep. It was
because those British guys are kind of stout. I mean,
there was nothing inevitable about any of the games. There was nothing inevitable. I mean, it could have gone, with the exception of the last game, you kind of started to fall apart quickly for the British. Other than that, there was nothing inevitable about those.
Really, directly the result of a calamity roll.
Yep.
That I had to make, which. It happened at the wrong time.
Yeah.
It happened at the worst possible moment.
Yeah.
And it
happened
because I had such a small force.
Yeah.
Essentially, the way the British play, and I think the advantage you guys had in the first game, is I tried to spread myself out with too few units.
Yeah.
So you couldn't flank me.
Yeah.
And I learned from the first game.
Yep.
I need everybody.
You need to make that battleship in the middle
and make you come to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what happened was, I got a bad roll. I had one of my units involuntarily
advance.
Charge out into the middle of the board on his own.
And activate.
And lose an activation.
And lose an activation. So basically, they charge right into an army of Zulus.
Yeah.
When I was going to say, to add to that list of catastrophes you mentioned, you had the wrong roll at the wrong time with the wrong unit facing the wrong enemy units. Because that happened on my side of the board. the way Tom and I had built our forces, we had different type of Zulu units. Yeah. Mine are the ones that had the his were better in combat. Mine had the longer charge range. So when you advanced up, you were just in the range of my units that had a longer charge range. Because if it done that against Tom, it wouldn't have worked. He had a shorter charge range. He still wouldn't have been able to close with you.
Yeah.
And I was able to close with multiple units once. Yeah. It was, again, waiting in the back for him to pounce. That was the trigger, and then it changed the whole dynamic.
And what we learned and remembered after the fact, that would have been a golden time to bite the bullet and re-roll that calamity.
That rule in the game. I had forgotten that option. Yeah. Though in a later game, I did use that.
Yeah.
Because once again, I had exactly the same situation.
And it worked out. It worked out the second time. It worked better.
It worked better.
It was less calamitous. And bite the bullet to understand that each force has basically a free reroll that they can use once a game. And sometimes in the heat of battle, you just forget you have that option.
I never
used
mine. I forgot.
Not until, and we'll get to this at the end, not until we switched eras, then we both were like dealing those bad boys out for that. Because, you know, we're going to call it the Memorial Ray rule because we got the same calamity. It's like, oh, hell no, I'm not doing what happened to him. And, you know,
kidding.
Yeah.
But that is.
Cautionary tale.
One of the things that I felt added a lot of flavor to the game is the British play very much like the end of the movie Zulu Dawn. You form this little huddle of units that dish out this ungodly amount of firepower.
Yeah.
And if you do it right, everybody dies trying to get up to you.
Yep.
Just like Zulu at the end, where there's this pile of bodies, you know, right outside. But what happens is if the Zulus do close to you and you start taking damage, because you have few units dishing out a lot of firepower, those hits hurt a lot more. Yeah.
And
your firepower drops.
And a lot of your advantages dwindle when your unit's no longer a certain strength. And, you know, so it
exactly.
If we gave you this, and here's yet another variable that would completely change the game. Could you imagine giving him a rock wall to be behind?
Not without more Zulus.
But I mean, we go Rourke's Drift on this thing, and I say it goes from there's nothing inevitable to, oh my God, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because if he's behind a fortification and flailing
mealy
out that
bags.
Kind of fire.
Yeah. I need mealy bags.
You do. And that would be like a cool next version of it.
Yeah. I would like to.
Some little outpost with hiding behind a wagon and a fence. Oh, dear Lord. But I'd be all over that. And I will bring, and they're nowhere near British rifles, but I will bring a little contingent of Zulus with muskets next time just to shake it up a little bit, because the thing with the current forces that we played, we didn't take any of the firearms for the Zulus.
No,
our only option was to close.
Yeah.
And that's still really realistically the only option, but the way we played it, there was no other option.
Correct. Because, as we were talking about earlier and those, mission cards, every game we played, we had our three objectives that were out on the board, but not in one game did they become important to accumulating victory points.
Right.
It was always something else.
Yeah, some of the cards say right away, the objectives play no role in your game.
Right.
And we just happen
over
to draw
three
the
games
ones.
For over both mission cards. We're talking about a total of six mission cards that we drew over those three games. The objectives never were the.
So what's really funny is he's drawn the same card every time, but we both drew the same card. I mean, that Vanguard card, and that's what it is, and it's one where you have to advance your leader across the board to create calamity on the other side. That card's been drawn an inordinate number of times on all of our sides. Every time with Richard, with Ray.
One card out of the deck, so I haven't figured out how that happened.
Yeah. But we did it multiple times during the campaign, and then we did it even in the next games that we played, the same rotten card, you know. So I think we're going to set fire to that card and move on. But
I also liked the nuances of, and we've talked a little bit about it from Ray's standpoint, the calamity and the fortune rolls, which you get off your rolling from your initiatives for your units. Ray, of course, had his more than fair share of calamitous roles that came up that put his units in bad places. But I remember even for us, we were getting a number of fortune rolls that were helping us too. I remember we got one particular fortune roll where we were debating its use, right, to put a fatigue on a unit or put a reload counter
right.
on the unit. And that was a big decision because we had some guys that were in range to charge his unit. The British units in this particular version of the game, this time period, don't get reload markers.
Right. They've got a repeating rifle. Yeah.
So by
Which is part of the British dumping out.
Because
I don't have to pause
in
between. I can shoot every turn.
Exactly.
You're not wasting an action on reloading.
And not only that, you're more efficient because most times when you're doing your two actions, you're getting that aim and fire action, which is improving the rate that you hit at. But when that fortune came up that said we could put a reload marker on a unit and we slapped it on one of yours, then we could charge in without the fear of defensive fire reprisals going our way.
And
so that was another little
tweak
that just helped us at the right time, at the right place, with the right unit.
I mean,
and it's those kind of things that you feel with the British disproportionately.
And, you know, but all everything we've just mentioned is just, it just, like you said, just fires me up to want to do it again. You know, so as a sample size, we've only done one. But our experience with that one was so positive that we're very, very fired up to do it again. You know, the other thing, and we've talked about this before when we had an episode on skirmish games, you know, the reality of it is this game was put on the table with very little work because it doesn't take a million miniatures to play this game. You know, we're still painting some of the stuff and, you know, whatever might be a little, you know, flocking on a base here and there. But we played this game. We played this game pretty quickly. And I, as we talk about next, I painted two armies for another era of this game and am really seriously considering. And do I want to say this out loud? I'm really seriously considering another time period, a custom time period. Get this, for Millennium Con.
Ah, okay.
But I'm not going to say what yet, because it's actually not even a force that's currently in the book, but it's one that's being worked on between myself and
Edgar. Going out of the book, I still have my Natal native contingent, which is a force unto itself. There are...
But legally, it's not.
They're all colonial troops. I am modeling that one...
Legally, it's not a force in the book, but it's a part of a force in the book, and we'll work around that absolutely. But I mean, there's a lot of stuff that can be done. I think across the board, it was a huge success, and I really appreciate Edgar and the guys for letting us try this. So what that's going to lead to the next thing. So before we were even finished painting Colonials, because I had a large number of this force painted for another game system. I just had to remount them. I went ahead and painted American Civil War for this game and came up with a force of about 7 units per side. So, I mean, it was a sizable armies for both sides. And Richard and I were the first ones to test it out. But then just last week, Ray and I and a lady that I work with, Isla, we tested it out. And you want to talk about an entirely different game when both sides can shoot? Man, that was a different game. And rifled muskets that require reloading.
Yes.
Oh.
Which I felt heavily because not being able to fire every turn.
For someone who was used to your British machine guns, it was a little different, wasn't it?
You don't have no laser guns anymore going off there.
You have to actually think about what you're going to do with each of your actions, and those die rolls where you get two actions instead of one.
Load and fire? Is that aim and fire, or is that fire and reload? You know, it's like, what's better, a real well aimed shot or shooting? You know, I'm going on shooting
because you get more dice.
But then also timing. You don't take that wild 24-inch shot where you have only, like, you have to roll 10 out of 10, and then the next turn you have to reload, and then the next turn he jabs your eyeballs out. You need to, like, you know, like, again, movie, you know, hold your fire, you know, and you blast his badoobies off, you know, right at range. So, you know, just that feature made this feel like a completely different
game.
But it was a system we already knew. There was just a couple of tweaks for like little, you know, things like that that we had to be aware of. We had some sharpshooters in the game, which had a few little things where you could
some nuances pick, there. Yeah, yes.
You had some sharpshooters in the game.
My sharpshooters died in the first turn. My sharpshooters shooted your sharpshooters, and there was no more sharpshooters. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, to keep this in context with this particular episode, you know, we're going to do an American Civil War campaign using the same rules, the same three game or four, if you're us, you know, context. And I feel like it's going to be radically different because of these horses. Now, would it be radically different if it was another all musket armed force? I don't know. You know, if you did Mexican American War, how different will it feel than Civil War? But then I'd also argue, how different should it feel? Because most of the tactics of the early American Civil War were what these people learned or forgot or learned poorly in the Mexican American War, you know? And then when you get into later, like Spanish American War, Gatling guns and things like that are a thing. So I think it will once again make it feel different, you know? So that's all you can hope for in a set of rules that covers such a long time period.
Right.
And not to foreshadow a future episode, but, you know, we're going to talk about these rules. We mentioned this going back to season one, like episode 3, when we talked about black powder and could a one set of rules realistically cover everything from, you know, 1702 to 1899. And the answer is asterisk yes, with the appropriate tinkering, you know, and, but we'll talk more about that in the next episode. But I am thrilled with this game.
Yeah, it's been fun, and it's been, like you said, it feels like a 2-for-1 or 3-for-1 punch when you get to have the different time periods and see a different gameplay out. Because you're right, with ACW, a very, very different game. Going from a game with Zulus where you were always trying to close to where it was the and it could have been just because of the way we played the game, a rarity when we did it. Yeah. Both sides sat around and tried to shoot your face off because, again, based on the cards that we had, too, that was also a factor. That's right.
We drew the same card where we had to go set fire to an objective.
Yeah, one of the cards. Exactly. And that was, you know, that you mentioned that game. That was the second game. That was the unusual one because I jumped out. I got two of the objectives out of the three, had the 2 points, but you had just shot my face off. And so you know, attrition and by just unit value wasn't going to work.
And that goes back to something, you know, to go back to the British colonial for a minute. And you talked about the fact that Ray developed attrition purely from casualties on the Zulus, you know, in a short amount of time. You know, we had to lose, I think it was like
12 after every 12 figures we got.
Yeah, we got an attrition
point.
But I mean, by fairly early in the game, we're already at the first attrition point because he'd gunned down. You know, and then depending on of course, you got the Vanguard the entire time, but, you know, other ones, as soon as you lose a unit, you might get another attrition point, or the first 2 units lost causes an attrition point. If the British draw that kind of card, they're going to win. Their likelihood of winning is greatly because we were losing entire units.
Right.
Because we would have gotten.
Because we would, you combine. It's adding attrition to the regular. It's adding the way you accumulate attrition points normally to units eliminated, which plays right into how the British play in that game.
Yep.
He was, I mean, we talked about this with that Vanguard card. He was, at best, he got one.
Yeah.
You know, if the lead, I think your leader got to the midpoint one time. He generated one outside
of casualties. And that was out of sheer desperation.
Well, that's the one that pulled the draw out. Right. That's when you got the draw to come and kick in.
Broke ranks and all by himself. That's he ran one. Out in the middle of the board.
He pulled a Burt Lancaster out with his pistol shooting at the middle of the board.
But you know, you just brought up got me thinking. Had I had the card you're talking about, where you accumulate attrition points by killing units, mm-hmm. I probably would have won those first two games.
It certainly would have been
it
way
would
closer.
Not have yep. been. I don't think it would have been a draw and a loss. I probably, because the Vanguard card forced me to move, not right. just stand and
that
shoot.
That is not your strong suit. You want
that, that is right. not
you want to be on the back edge of the board as yep. far away as you can, getting as many shots in as you can
because
before.
By the second game, I gave up trying to accumulate attrition points against you guys by moving out to the yeah. middle of the board. I decided it was more advantageous to just say, screw it, I'll stand here and shoot you yep. guys
yep. I
to
agree.
Pieces.
100%. That card doesn't play well for
it
the bridge.
Gives some, it, that card does not. But the one we're talking about where you get extra for limiting units to get mm-hmm. you also accumulate attrition points for it also plays very weirdly. There was some weird thinking that had to go on about what you were going to do. Because I think we both had that card at our first mission playing ACW.
Yep.
And I remember in the beginning trying to whittle down the unit to get the extra attrition point. Mm-hmm. But then you began to realize, well, as they got smaller, you lost that. I can't remember the name of the special rule. Big unit or
yeah,
drilled yeah. because you were below the unit count.
Right,
and that drilled formation gave you big target, which made you easier to hit.
Right,
now you're faced with this dilemma. Okay, I can try and shoot the guys that are remaining at a worse odds because you're no longer a big unit.
Yeah.
Or I can turn my attention to the fresh unit over here that I'm going to get all the bonuses with
right.
and start whittling it down to limit your fire.
Right.
And so it wasn't always the automatic call of, yeah, I'm just going to pound this into dirt and
right.
dust because of what's facing me off yeah, to the other side.
Which am I earning the attrition from the easiest?
Right.
Taking yep. four off of each unit or eliminating one.
Right.
Yeah.
So it played it did have a play where it didn't automatically assume that you were going to take it off. Because I remember I abandoned that to reduce unit sizes. So it would
yep.
reduce your fire and it'd be easier to hit.
Yep, that's right. So, I mean, all of this, I mean, may or may not make any sense to people that don't know the rules, but you can hear that there are a lot of alternatives and a lot of options to make these games very different. And again, that's you want that. You don't want every time you sit down and play the game, it's the same game. You know, it's one of the things that...
Exactly. Just by changing the mission card, yep. you can have the same table set up, the same forces on the table, the arm, everything can be identical. But just by drawing a different mission card, you've got a very different game.
Yep. Which is Ray yet to experience. Isn't
yes, that's right. But it's one of the things... You know, it's
I experienced
one,
it by watching you
there
guys.
There you go, yeah, watching
right,
us see
yeah,
different missions.
Living
yes.
vicariously through us getting different cards. But, you know, but it's part of my mental block, and I know very clearly, and I want to be honest, my mental block about Ancients games that tend to kind of always shake out is my line, you know, Red Rover, throw a spirit, you know. You know, this goes a long ways to making every game a slightly different environment, and therefore you walk away with different smack to talk, you know, at a point. So, yeah, I'm thrilled with it. I recommend it to anybody. I know a couple of folks out there have said on the Facebook page, you know, damn you, I ran out and bought a copy of the rules. You're going to love it. I really think you're going to love it.
Yeah, one other thought about the mission cards and talking about the Vanguard card not complementing the British real well.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to point out, though, that is very much a part of the real world.
Yeah.
Armies are not always given the task. Units are not always given the task that they're best suited for.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to do what you got to do with
what you've
got.
We've talked about that before in things like Flames of War or whatever, that, you know, should you draw the mission before you organize the force? Because, yeah, you don't always get to make the
custom
Rangers with
it,
the
yes.
battleship supporting, you know, for everything you need. Sometimes, like you yep. said, you got this, you got a stick, and, you know, you got to MacGyver this to get to where you need to be. You know, I could see playing it both ways. A well-planned operation versus the breakthrough attack, and it's, you know, it's six artillerists and a cook and, you know, and an accountant exactly. trying to defend the, you know.
But I felt like I needed to point that out because it sounds like something just on the surface that is undesirable, but I think it adds to the game.
Oh, yeah.
The historical feel of the game.
I would argue that's true in all point-based games, that they yes. play better to a degree at a lower point level when you have to make some hard choices about all the toys. You know, yeah, we're going to play an 18,000-point Flames of War game with, you know, three battalions of Tiger Tank. No. Let's play a 40-point game and you get a horse and a panzer fat, you know, when you have to make those hard choices, it makes.
Or if you want your Tiger Tank, that's all you got.
Yep. Exactly.
You're playing Fury again.
All of a sudden,
somewhere.
We're playing Fury in reverse, right? You know, except I'm using the panzer fouls. But yeah, but I think, yeah, you. It, ultimately, these games are problem solving.
Exactly.
Right? You're using the things you have to complete, whether defend yourself or attack or whatever. You've got to make do with the things you have. It's a rare environment where you have every single thing you need right when you need it. You know? Well, I think we've beaten this dead horse, but I can't recommend either the game or hopefully very soon available through Firelock Games, this little campaign system. And I'm gonna tell you, as it is right now, I'm sure they're gonna fluff it up and make it pretty, but it's like two pages. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes mm-hmm. it beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I was reading it off my phone as we were doing this. So, Edgar, if you're out there, get this thing out because it's gonna be a hoot for many, many people.
Good yep. job.
It's a very game. True statement. A lot of rules don't make a lot of games.
No, that's right. That's right. It's like anything, you know, the old writing thing. Can you make a horror story in six paragraphs or whatever? It's like, yeah, those few that can are artists, you know, and the rest of them are the blubbering idiots that need an 18-part series to.
Back in the day when I used to write, I used to do that. I considered it a challenge. I'd try to write an entire short story in a paragraph.
I just remember, I'm going to end on this, and I don't remember the movie, and it was just some rom-com that my first wife made me go to. But Kirstie Alley played a writer in the movie, and she was going through a depressive moment. And her sister said, but you used to write all those short stories. And she cries, they weren't short stories. I just didn't finish them. All right, Chantel, take us out.
This has been Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Subscribe on all major podcatchers, and please rate and review us. You can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/ABA1. Patreon.com/ABA1. See you next time.